That's music from Terry Clark. Yeah, he was one of the early ones, one of the Jesus people back there in the early 70s. And when Christian music went pop and got on the radio and started a whole new breed of radio station, too, was really the birth of Christian radio as we know it today. Jesus Mighty Fortress. It's 11 minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and so we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don, fresh back from California. I can see him there with a tan and a very kind of a casual look in his eye. Are you feeling a little laid back, Don?
Oh, very laid back, yes. It was pleasant to go to California and go to a, it's called the Unified Symposium, Unified Grape and Wine Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
And it was held at the Sacramento Convention Center.
Okay.
And the exhibit area was just, it was just huge. Mm-hmm. It covered over three floors, but the main floor, of course, was, I would say that it was even bigger than the conference at the NRB.
Oh, really? Well, okay.
The expo at the NRB. Yeah. So, very interesting. Learned some good things. We spent most time in discussions talking about bottling, because mm-hmm. that's kind of where we are. We're about to come up on with our wine here.
Okay.
In April or so.
How long does wine age in casks typically? I mean,
it depends on the wine, but okay. a good red will age 18 months to 20 to 24 months.
Okay. And yep. And so if you see it on the shelf and it says like it's 3 or 4 or even 5 years old, is that good, or does it make any difference, or do you just have to know the year when the grapes were good? I mean, does that near mean any, that vintage mean anything?
Well, it could. I mean, it depends on the, like I said, it depends on the wine.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on who made it, because not all wineries are using oak barrels, for example, to age mm-hmm. their wine. There's a number of different ways to do that. You can put oak chips, oak cubes, mm-hmm. oak staves, in your wine to get that oaky flavor.
I've noticed that nowhere on any wine label that I've ever read does it say aged in polyethylene. Never says that.
Well, interesting that you mentioned that, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of polyethylene tanks that are used for winemaking.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. If you find a Pinot Grigio or a Chardonnay on the shelf and it's 5 years old, it should be in the remainder bin.
Aha. Uh-huh.
You should be able to get a discount.
Okay, because white wine doesn't last that long, does it?
No. Generally speaking, it doesn't. And usually, if it's got a golden hue to it, mm-hmm. if you hold it up to the light and the bottle is clear, and it's got a little bit of a golden hue to it, don't open that bottle.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, or you could just use it like vinegar, couldn't you? Or is it actually harmful?
It's turned.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's bad for you, Don. Do you know? I mean, it's are you going to get sick and die from it?
No. It's just it just oxidizes with age. I mean, most wineries will put SO2 or potassium metabisulfite into the wine to preserve it from oxidation. But the problem with the whites is you don't have a lot of tannins in them, because the tannins come from the skins and the seeds.
Yeah.
You don't ferment the whites with the skins and the seeds like you do with the reds.
Uh-huh.
So reds will last a lot longer, and the more tannins you have in the wine, the longer, I mean, on an average, they will last, because the tannins also serve as an antioxidant.
Okay. Well, Dr. Don, by the way, if you haven't caught on, grows wine, and no, he doesn't grow wine. He grows grapes and makes wine from them.
Wine doesn't grow on trees,
does it? No. So that he was off at the seminar. We love to pick his brain about wine. We learn a lot from Dr. Don. This morning, the topic is not really wine, though. It's frogs. Not any frog, but frogs that supposedly were extinct. This is an Associated Press story posted by Katie Daigle about a week ago. And Don, this is about frogs in northeast India. And I just made a connection here. It's the Darjeeling area, which is known for tea, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and rainforest, tropical trees, and apparently that's the habitat for this tree frog, which was not unknown, but the last specimens had been collected back in 1870 by a British naturalist, and up until now they figured this frog is history. It's gone. There, and then all of a sudden, lo and behold, science changes its mind again, because now they're able to say, aha, we found them again. They're not extinct, nor were they ever. Here's where they live. A lot of research going on up there, isn't there?
Well, there is, and it's an interesting story of how the Indian professor actually found the frogs, Dr. Diju, he's known fondly as the frog man.
Yeah.
So
I can see, I can picture him now. Yeah.
Yeah. He's identified over, 89 of 350 frog species that we know.
Okay.
Known to be in the country, that is India. They were out searching the forest floor for reptiles and amphibians, and they were out there at night, and they hear this cacophony of music, as he says, of music in the trees, and it turned out to be these frogs.
I can relate to that too. I just want to tell a story here. Are you familiar with tree frogs, or with what's known as peepers? In the east and south and in the wooded areas?
Well, I don't know if we have green tree frogs in the south.
Well, but do they sing to you? Because the music is an apt description of what happens. Now, we used to live on a lake surrounded by woods. And one of the greatest delights in spring was when the tree frogs awoke. And they're called peepers because they make this peeping sound. And these are little half-inch frogs that live in the trees, in holes in trees and stuff. And there are a bazillion of them out there, and when they all get together, they tend to sing together. They unify into a tone, and then there's another species of frog, and I'm guessing that it's another species. I don't think the same one would do this, that they get together and echo what these frogs are doing, but at a different pitch that harmonizes. And I've stood out there in the woods and just been mesmerized by this music coming from the darkness in the trees. So when this biologist says music in the trees, he's not kidding. It is an awesome thing to hear. So, and it's a beautiful thing to hear. So I just wanted to put in that plug for the tree frog, because you hardly ever get to see them.
But yeah, these apparently can live up to 20 feet in the air in holes in the trees. And so you wouldn't see those too often unless you decided to climb the tree.
Yeah, which is a good reason to think that maybe that's why they thought they were lost. But I continue to be amazed at how science revises its earlier thinking. Now, that's a normal process, but they sound so sure the first time around, don't they?
Well, they do, but in this case, when you talk about classification, and this is when Dr. Bijou did DNA analysis of these tree frogs, he decided, this is a new genus. Of course, the lowest classification, or the finest classification, if you will, is a species, and then above the species is a genus. Compared basically a DNA fingerprint, and it would be similar to what might be used in forensic science to determine whether or not you're related to somebody else.
Yeah, but see, now just a minute here. It seems to me that in itself promotes evolution. Because rather than saying these are two separate entities, each having some similarities, like webs between their fingers or the width of their snout, we're saying that they came from a common ancestor. The genus is over them. Rather than saying two completely individual creations, we're saying one stemmed from a predecessor. That's built into that classification system, isn't it?
Well, yeah, evolutionary thinking is certainly built into the classification mm-hmm. system. It didn't necessarily have to be. I mean, because as you suggested, the classification was first built on morphology, if you will, or phenotype. What does this animal look like, and does this animal look like some other animal, or and it could be plant?
That's not illogical. I mean, yeah.
And then now that we have DNA fingerprinting, we can at least look at the at the DNA and say, is this DNA similar to any other animal that we have out there? And this is a tricky subject because actually DNA is being used by the evolutionists to say, aha, you see, that creature evolved from this other creature. Instead of saying, well, all of these animals are related, and perhaps instead of looking at the genus, we should be looking at the families and then saying which family belongs in which. And I'll give you an example, which everybody knows about, is the family of the dog family, for example. If you've got a dog, we know that there's all hundreds, if not thousands, of different types of dogs. And they can range from, a little Chihuahua on up to a Great Dane and everything in between. And then you come to something like a wolf or a fox, and you say, well, is that in the same, are those related? And we should be saying, yes, they're in the same kind. They're the same kind of animal. And so from a creationist point of view, we would look at the dog or the fox and the coyotes and those type of animals, all in the same family. They have diverged from each other because the animals God gave us the ability to multiply, but with variability. So not everybody necessarily looks the same. So we're not perfect clones of one another, but you might look like your father, or your daughter might look like your mother, or your daughter may look like you. But given separation of a little bit of time and genetic variability, you wind up having people looking looking a little bit different than one another. And that differences can reflect itself in skin color and shape of the eyes and the mouth and the nose and the ears and various other things, as well as hair color. But we're all we're all humans. And the same thing when it comes to other areas of biology that, frogs are frogs, and yes, this one might live in the tree because of in holes in the tree that are filled with water, as this particular frog does. And there may be many frogs that live like that because they don't have little ponds around for them to, the frog still goes from an egg to a tadpole, from a tadpole, to a frog. So it goes through the same cycles, and you would definitely call it a frog because it looks like a frog. Mm-hmm. but there are some slight variations. They might make a different sound, for example. They might eat different types of food. They maybe are raised a little bit differently.
Well, in this case, there's quite a difference. These little frogs, it says here, are fed by their mothers with unfertilized eggs. She comes back to where they are in water-filled holes in trees and feeds them with her own unfertilized eggs. This is a pretty amazing process.
Well, in that, I read that too, and I'm thinking about it. And I say, well, does that mother frog really think that it's feeding its young with the eggs, or is she trying to lay more eggs? Now, the biologist or naturalist or, you know, is saying that they're unfertilized. How does he know they're unfertilized? They could be fertile eggs. And she's just coming back to lay more eggs. But now that you have tadpoles in the water hole in the tree, the tadpoles start eating the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he discovered was that these specimens that he took they had eggs in their stomach.
They seem specially adapted to ingesting eggs.
Although, you know, I would think any frog could eat eggs, you know, and especially, you know, eggs of their own species. I don't see that as necessarily a problem, but to jump to the conclusion that the mother tadpole is actually laying, and specifically saying infertile eggs, I think is a little bit of a stretch without doing a little more research on that. Sometimes we imply things that really aren't necessarily there.
See, it's interesting how you look at it differently, because I read that and I just plain accepted it. Okay. She's feeding her tadpoles. It was automatic.
Yeah, and that's science.
I'm feeling so gullible now.
it seems like it's rather inefficient that the mom will go to that extent to spend a limited resource that would procreate the species and expand, and she's feeding them. And,
well, see, you're gullible too. You just said she's feeding them. She might just be laying more eggs. Period.
Well, yep. I mean, she's putting the eggs in the water so that they're protected. I mean,
natural urge, I suppose.
Yeah, and the tadpoles don't have teeth; they have little suckers. So
I don't know of any tadpoles that have teeth, though.
What's that?
I don't know of any tadpole that has teeth. Do you?
Oh yeah.
You ever been bitten by a tadpole?
Oh yeah, many times. we have the Bay Lake teethy tadpole.
Oh, okay. That's
very,
see.
Very, very destructive. Yeah. Oh. You get a hold of one of those, and you're gonna feel it.
Yeah.
There was a part of the article that said that the mouth of the tadpole is designed to not damage the egg.
Aha, uh-huh. Is designed.
Well, you know, that's
must
what
have,
that's,
must have been. Must have been a check, slip up there. Sure I think.
That, let me check to make sure that, okay. that that's what he
well,
really
but, you
said.
Know, all I'm trying to say is those are assumptions.
Yeah, and, you're right.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
May or may not be true, because okay, you have a if you look at the environment, you got a hole in a tree, right? And so the tree is eventually going to die. But anyway, you got this hole in the tree. It's a rainy environment. The hole is filled with water. It's an environment that a frog could survive, or frogs or tadpoles could survive, and. Since it is a wet environment, I'm sure they have mosquitoes, and mosquitoes will lay their, you know, their eggs in the same water, and the frogs are probably eating insects as well. The tadpoles are eating whatever, you know, life would be in in that water hole. And so the mother comes along and just lays, oh, here's another water hole, and lays more eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And the tadpoles just see that as more food and not necessarily distinguish that from a mosquito larva.
And then this scientist in his white lab coat comes along and says, aha, she's feeding them. She's caring for her tadpoles. And that is a big assumption.
Mm.
I'm not even sure how you could verify that with an experiment.
Now, I don't know, it doesn't mention it in the particular story, but have the eggs been found to have been digested? That they've actually consumed the eggs, or they're just storing them inside their body?
Are we talking tadpole poop here?
Yeah. No. We're talking about tadpole, you know, leavings.
Yeah.
You know, tadpole scat.
Well, what was found was, if you look at, in the tadpoles are relatively translucent, and there's a picture of it in the article. And
yeah,
so if you stick them under a microscope, which he did, and he found that, oh, look at that, they have eggs in their intestines.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he found.
Sure.
And then from there, he concludes that the female tadpole who laid the eggs in the beginning is actually feeding the young, which to me is just a big jump without having further evidence. How do we know it's not another female tadpole that's laying its eggs in the water hole? And, you know, are frogs mm-hmm. territorial? I mean, I don't know if they necessarily fight off, other frogs.
No, probably not the females. The yeah.
But it basically goes down to, you know, sometimes there are a lot of assumptions that go mm-hmm. into these statements. Yeah. And you just have to look at it critically to say, is that true, or is it just happenstance mm-hmm. that, this is what's going on? I wouldn't necessarily make a new genus out of it, but if there's, if there's some DNA evidence that suggests that this is nothing like, and you'd have to have a library of DNA in order to make conclusions like this, too, mm-hmm. that we're not finding any, relative of this particular frog that we found. And so, therefore, we're going to call this a new frog.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there's some interesting pictures. These are cute little frogs. The link is now in our chat window on the Broken Road webpage there. So you can take a look at these pictures along with us and read the articles. Kind of interesting. But again, what the question that pops out of this article for me is that there's all these old assumptions about these frogs not obsolete. What's the word?
Extinct.
And then all of a sudden they're here again. So science, it revises its thinking. And they're all hundreds of species, and they don't know which ones are going and which ones are staying and what's happening. But there are all these assumptions, as you've just described. And DNA comes along now. DNA research, the ability to use DNA to find answers. And I'm just wondering if DNA can be used to actually contradict these evolutionary assumptions. I mean, is DNA research unequivocal? Is it precise?
Well, no, because I'll give you an example. It depends on what you do, what type of analysis you do, and you can do it. You can do this by computer, for example, initial conclusions by evolutionists were, you see, there's a lot of DNA homology between a chimpanzee and the human.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the first statements that came out, 98% of the DNA is homologous between a chimpanzee and human.
Common to both.
Common to both.
Yeah.
All right. Now, when you drill down and ask, okay, well, how was the research actually done? Well, it was done on a computer, and it was done by matching up the, short DNA sequences. But it was done with a selective set of DNA from both the human and the chimpanzee. So what was done first was, let's look at the DNA that is homologous between the humans and the chimps. Let's take that set and let's see what percentage that DNA matches.
Mm-hmm.
So you're already subsetting the DNA. You're not looking at all of the DNA. You're subsetting the DNA into a group, and you're saying, okay, I only want to look at the DNA that is homologous or similar between the chimp and the humans. And when you do that analysis, you come up with 98%. Well, you've already pre-selected.
See, that sounds like bad science.
It is bad science. You know, if you looked at the total DNA pool between the two, you come up with an answer that, maybe 70% or 74% of the DNA is similar. And the similar is in quotes, because you have to look at, how long the DNA segments are. And the shorter you get, of course, the more similar, mm-hmm. Similarities you get between the two, things that you're looking at. So to be able to do an honest analysis, one, you'd have to sequence all of the DNA from every species, from every animal on Earth, and then, you know, compare and know which DNA sequences, for example, code for proteins and which areas don't code for proteins. I mean, there was a time in science, in early the early analysis of DNA, when they said, you know, this DNA that doesn't code for protein is just junk and is just left over from the evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
So there was errors that were made, and that just got carried along as, you know, as junk DNA, and it didn't code for anything, and so it's not really worth anything, and it's just the noise in the signal type of stuff, and that just, of course, you know, the more in quote advanced species, hence, you know, humans, we have more of that junk DNA than other species, for example. Well, I mean, we know now, for example, that junk DNA is not junk DNA at all, that it is has everything to do with control and which genes are expressed at which time and how the DNA is folded on each other, how it's unfolded. I mean, the list just goes on and on of the specificity that is required in this so-called junk DNA area. So... Mm. So it's not junk at all. As a matter of fact, it is. If you have a defect in, you know, one of those areas, it's just as detrimental to the organism as a defect in the coding region. You know, the coding region that codes for protein.
So no matter how precise DNA analysis is, it's still subject to human error by bad assumptions. There's a large subjective element to the conclusions.
And that goes for any branch of science.
Mm.
Mm.
So it's not just, you know, biology or DNA analysis or whatever. I mean, it could go for physics. It can go in cosmology in particular. You have to make assumptions about what you're seeing. And the more limited information that you have, because, gee, we can't travel, great distances yet. we can't necessarily investigate from a hands-on type of thing. The more assumptions you have to make.
Interesting. Mm. Interesting article too.
There are generally other fields of science. In biology, there's the assumption of evolution and all the things it brings with it. I'm not sure what category of science you'd put global warming in, but all the huge assumptions made in that particular category. Are there other fields of science that rely on, large assumptions that very probably will be off a great deal?
Well, I can't think of a science that isn't.
Oh, okay.
You know,
that narrows it down. Okay, well, all right then.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in chemistry because I'm a biochemist, the more disciplined, if you will, the more defined science, whether it's chemistry or physics, I think we can pretty much, we've got Newton's laws down, and we know that Einstein's equations reduce down to Newton's equations on the macro scale, but on the micro scale, you know, it tells you something completely different. or the super macro scale, for example, if you're looking at the cosmos. So we know that Newton's laws, you know, there is such a thing as gravity, and objects do have weight, and they do, you know, they do fall at a certain speed, not necessarily dependent on their mass, as Newton discovered. in those type of laws, I mean, but they're called laws because they're not changing. I mean, we have observed this over and over and over again, and they're not changing. So there are that type of science. But when you start trying to interpret, especially in this case, animal behavior, there's a lot of assumptions that are being made. We just have to be aware of those assumptions and then just ask the question, well, does that make sense or does it not make sense? And maybe your assumptions are correct and maybe there aren't. But the bottom line is what, and this goes for interpreting the Bible as well, but what is your fundamental, guiding principle? If your fundamental guiding principle is that everything evolved, everything that we see, you know, that the universe was once nothing and now just exploded in the Big Bang, you're going to look for evidence for that assumption. If, on the other hand, your assumption is, well, no, the Bible is correct and God spoke everything into existence, then you're going to look at things from that perspective. And so you look at all of these species of frogs, in this case, since that's what we're talking about, and genuses of frogs, and you're saying, well, yep, it's a frog, and it's adapted to its environment because our Creator God gave it the ability to change enough to adapt to different types of conditions, as opposed to saying, well, that frog evolved from some other frog, and that's why it's able to live. So, you come up, basically, you're looking at the same frog, you're looking at all the other frogs, and you're coming up with two different conclusions based on what your operating premise is.
Excellent explanation, and that goes to the heart of so much of what we talk about here with Dr. Don. It seems if you throw off the rules, that is the structure, the matrix from which your knowledge comes, and you just operate from nothing to start with, you're prone to error. That, as you say, there's no greater truth to this than what we're able to deduce, and therefore we can conclude just about anything we want to conclude. There are no rules, no limits. There are these laws, the natural laws you've mentioned, but without that first assumption that either the universe came from nothing or someone, a creator, a designer, is responsible for it, that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, it does, and it carries on into all aspects of life. I mean, because you can, I'll give you another unrelated, it's not scientific, but another unrelated field, the legal field. Right. Mm-hmm. And so in the legal field, you have, you pass a bill, for example, and it says, we're going to pick up, trash every Thursday morning in this neighborhood, whatever it is, mm-hmm. Whatever the law is, you got to stop at the stop sign. We're going to have traffic lights, whatever that law is. If you have evolutionary thinking, then this law that you passed can evolve and can change. You don't need another law to change the law. You just reinterpret it, mm-hmm. because that's what we come from an ever-changing world, and we need to change. We need to change this law, and so it's not concrete; it's fluid.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what's going on in our legal system, and especially what the founding fathers in this country, for example, established, is being looked at. Well, that can evolve. We can evolve into something else.
What you're saying is, without an anchor, you tend to drift over time.
You do.
I got a couple of good examples. I just finished listening to a book called Flash Kids or Flash Boys, one or the other. And it's about high-frequency trading in the stock market. And the simple, short definition of that is they developed, or somebody has developed, a fast communication system using fiber optics that will allow a broker or someone who is an investor to send out an offer to sell 100 shares of something. And then if somebody says, I'll buy those shares at this price, then before they've made that decision, the first broker sends out an offer to sell the shares at a higher price. And, you know, in essence, what the second investor has been, he's just had his pocket picked. He's just been slickered for whatever the amount of the investment was. And I listened to this book all the way through, and I said, there's got to be regulations here somewhere. Somebody has got to be as impressive, as introspective, as involved in the government as it is in my life. Somebody must have figured this out. Somebody must have told the guys over at the SEC this is going on. Why don't they do something about it? Well, still nothing has been done about it. It was up to the free market to fix it, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a 60 Minutes report on Sunday night about money from criminal enterprises being moved from place to place to place overseas, and then in essence sanitized or laundered, and then the money being used to buy skyscrapers and big buildings and yachts and planes and whatever. And they were concentrating on New York in real estate. And it was somebody that did a sting where they went in and talked to a number of attorneys to see if they'd be willing to do the legal work to get that stuff done. And out of the 16 they talked to, 15 said, yeah, I think I can help you. Where are the laws? And, you know, one of the things that the piece never mentioned, never said anything about, somewhere there's a congressman or a senator who has written that law that allows that particular activity to go on. Somebody somewhere, it's probably,
By omission, if not some other reason.
Yeah, El Chapo has a legal team that has put together some laws or regulations that he sent up to his favorite congressman. And he's told him, he said, the next time you guys do a really complicated income tax bill, slip this in, will you? Hmm. Somewhere that law is on the books allowing that money to be transferred into the United States. And so the guy sells, 58 million tons of heroin, makes a really nice profit, and buys an apartment building. But that's the piece, that's the element that was never talked about in the 60 Minutes piece. What about the law? The law has changed somehow, and it wasn't, according to the original founders' desire. I don't think that the original founders wanted the population to figure out some way to steal people's money.
And what makes this possible is technology that makes decisions, buy and sell decisions, in milliseconds.
Yeah, right.
And the laws are not able to accommodate that or to protect against evil done using that technique. So again, that's drifting without an anchor. And the law should be.
Yeah, the only rationale for that is individual greed. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with freedom and liberty. It's just a way of stealing money out of people's, and almost like a connected story is that there was a law passed in the December budget bill that allowed, under certain conditions, some pension plans or some pension funds to trim the benefits of retirees. So you're sitting at home and you're 75 years old and you're kind of semi enjoying life and you only have to eat cat food once a month as opposed to three times a week, and all of a sudden your retirement portfolio disappears and the pension company says, we're going to have to cut your benefits by 30% or 40% or 10%. That's my money. What happened to it? Well, Congress has decided in its infinite wisdom that that's okay to trim. That's okay. Somebody's made a bad decision somewhere, and we're going to make sure that Dave's neighbor, Ed Shimoleski, is going to pay for it.
Yeah.
There are things going on in this very complex you know, society that, you know, that is, people are using technology to fleece us and separate us from our money.
I guess there's some similarities to the world of science. And the question in science would be, once you discover you've been going in the wrong direction for a generation, how do you fix that?
Yeah.
Like with the junk DNA, you said that so much false research was done based on that assumption. How do you undo the damage?
Well, I mean, of course, an honest scientist would say, okay, well, we made a wrong assumption, and it turns out that this stuff is really meaningful, and we better pay attention to it. And then you admit your error and look at it from a different viewpoint from then on out.
But then the textbooks hang around for another generation, don't they?
Yeah, and unfortunately, it will continue to be in textbooks years and years into the future, because it helps tell the evolutionary story, and it doesn't, you know, but the error helps tell the evolutionary story, but the correction, of course, helps tell the creation story. Okay. All of this obviously boils down to what's in the heart of man. And, if the heart is deceitfully wicked, then we're going to have, regardless of what laws you put on the books, regardless of what science looks at or a scientist looks at, if the heart of man is evil, and you come from that premise, then, we can expect, the things that we're seeing. And the more evil that the heart of man becomes, then actually the less freedom everybody has.
Yeah, and the tie-in between science and metaphysics here is really, we've talked about it here, the degradation over time of DNA. You know, it's not what it once was.
Right.
And that, of course, brings us back to Dr. Don's theory of devolution, which is something we talk about fondly here as we watch things slipping over the edge. Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to mention their website to you, creationmoments.com. You can link to it for Broken Road Radio, and you'll discover lots of stuff there, photos, DVDs, and books, and blogs, and information that talks about young Earth creationism. And the thing that I marvel at with Creation Moments is that it doesn't do it emotionally. It does it scientifically, rationally, objectively in its presentation of this information. So there's no need to raise your hackles or have your feathers ruffled. You can just see what exists on the other side of the argument, the side of the argument that really seldom gets seen. Creation Moments is a champion of scientific findings that reveal not only the truth of Genesis, but the whole idea of young Earth creationism. So even if you never opened the Bible, you'll find a convincing argument for that there. And the fact that the two go hand in glove just makes the argument overwhelming. So I recommended a trip to creationmoments.com. And Don, as always, we're grateful that you were with us, and hope you can get back and digest all that new information, that fancy wine stuff that you learned about, and have a successful week. We'll see you next week.
Okay, sounds very good. And good to be back.
Thanks, Don.
We'll see you next Tuesday. Bye-bye.
So long.